What I think happened was this. In the Bible, we're told that we eat the Paschal lamb with matzah and bitter herbs. And then along come the Romans, and they see people eating bitter herbs, and they say, "Didn't you know that bitter herbs were bad for you?" And the Jews said, "Oh, we didn't know that." And so they said, "Don't worry, you can dip it into something that we call embama, and it'll be okay."
Welcome to 18 Jewish Foods, Culture and History, in kosher bite-sized portions. This podcast tells the stories of iconic Jewish dishes, shedding light on the people who eat them. Here's your host, Joel Haber.
So Passover is coming up very soon, and already two episodes ago, I discussed matzah as well as many of its derivatives. There are many special foods for this holiday, and in this episode, I'm going to be discussing one that's a bit different. It is ancient, but is not commanded in the Torah in the way that matzah is. And also for the first time, I will be using the episode to look at a whole class of foods as well. So today's food is charoset. And charoset is best described as a fruity, nutty condiment, often also including wine and sometimes spices. The Ashkenazic version, the one that probably many of my listeners know best, is traditionally made with apples, walnuts, cinnamon, and red wine, sometimes also some sugar. But there are many different versions of charoset from around the world. In fact, some of them are even called by other names. The fruits might be dates, figs, raisins, lots of other things. I've seen bananas even at times. And the nuts also may vary drastically. I've been making seder for about 25 years now or so, and when I make my charoset, I typically use pecans rather than walnuts, simply because I prefer the flavor. And once or twice I've had people over who had tree nut allergies but were not allergic to almonds, so I used those instead. The ingredients vary widely. One of the surprising ingredients for many people today, considering that charoset is almost universally sweet, is that in older times, vinegar was almost always included. And this is because one of the symbolisms that the Talmud applies to charoset is that it is supposed to represent apples. And apples in ancient times or in older times were actually sour rather than sweet as they are today. To remember this fact, I often will include balsamic vinegar. It still gives the acidic element of the vinegar, but is slightly sweet, so it keeps it moderately sweet. Spices are also key. Cinnamon is a very common one, not only in Ashkenazic charosets. I know that in Morocco, where sometimes they make their charoset out of dates into sort of little truffle balls, it's sometimes rolled in cinnamon. Now, most of what I know about charoset comes from one source, and so I decided to speak with the person who created that source. Susan Weingarten is an archaeologist and a food historian, specializing in particular in food in the Talmuds. And in 2019, she published the book about charoset. It is called Charoset, A Taste of Jewish History. Can you tell me a little bit about what you uncovered in terms of the earliest versions of charoset and maybe when or how it became instituted?
Well, today, charoset is almost always sweet, but in ancient times, it wasn't quite like that. The very earliest certain mention of charoset is in the Mishnah, which is 3rd century. And it doesn't tell us very much about it. It just says we need spices for charoset. What I think happened was this. In the Bible, we're told that we eat the Paschal lamb with matzah and bitter herbs. And then along come the Romans, and they see people eating bitter herbs, and they say, "Didn't you know that bitter herbs were bad for you?" And the Jews said, "Oh, we didn't know that." And so they said, "Don't worry, you can dip it into something that we call embama, and it'll be okay." In fact, there is a document in the archive of leftovers that we call the Cairo Geniza, which translates Haroset as Embama.
I wanted to ask you about that Embama because it is a really interesting link. There's not a lot of information we have about what Embama was other than that it was used for dipping, correct?
No, we do have some ingredients. There are some people say it was made of hyssop and vinegar. Some people say it was made of mint. And there are sporadic haroset versions of haroset that are made with hyssop and are made with mint, but not many. In the single cookery book that survives from Roman times, which is called after a famous gourmet called Apicius, there is a recipe for embama, which it says is a very good thing for your digestion. In other words, we're coming back to the medical uses.
And the word embama, if I'm not mistaken, derives from the verb to dip, correct?
Right. The word embama means a dip, and it comes from the word to dip, which is embapto. Same word as in baptism, where people are dipped into water.
Mm. Is it possible that the term embama didn't mean a specific recipe and it was sort of a collective term for a dipping sauce?
I'm sure you're right there. And the interesting thing is that in the Apicius collection, it says it will correct lettuce and...
Endives.
Endives. In other words, lettuce was in those days much more bitter than it is nowadays, and endives are still bitter, and it's for correcting them.
If, as you're suggesting, I think plausibly, that its origins were not as a symbolic food, but rather just as, you know, something that was perhaps healthful or for taste purposes, now, and not just now, but already by the time of the Talmud, it acquires all sorts of symbolic purposes.
Right. The Jerusalem Talmud starts off by saying that haroset is in memory of the clay. And then another rabbi comes up and says, no, it's in memory of the blood. And if it's in the memory of the clay, it should be thick. And if it's in memory of the blood, it should be liquid. It doesn't say which blood. And there's a lot of blood around the Passover story. In the Babylonian Talmud, they also talk about thick clay, but they add to it that it's also in memory of the apple. It's only medieval commentators who tell us what the apple's about.
One of the little surprising things that people, you know, people know about it already because it's one of these surprising tidbits, is the Jews who will actually grind up a piece of brick into their haroset. And you pointed out that there was pushback from certain rabbis that basically said this is a ridiculous custom.
Oh, yes, that I love that. First of all, I actually went and photographed a family from Gibraltar who still do it, who still put in ground.
Did you eat it?
I didn't eat it. He was just sprinkling a tiny little pinch of dust in, just
to check the box.
Just to keep up the tradition, not so that it would you'd feel it with your teeth. The chidah. Chaim David Azoulay in the 18th century is very angry with it. He says, this is crazy. We're supposed to be going from sadness to joy. How come they're putting this in? It's a ridiculous thing and you should give it up. And then he says, and maybe the reason for it is that somebody saw a text which says, grind up the haroset. And there was a printing error. And the last letter of haroset, the T, fell off. And you had grind up the cheres. And cheres is a word for a potsherd.
Ah, it's hilarious, yeah. Certainly possible.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
On the topic of symbolism, I think the most commonly quoted reasoning for haroset is that it symbolizes the mortar of the bricks. And this is not necessarily wrong. I think it simply is a misappropriation of an English term. It is not the mortar of the bricks. The mortar is what goes between the bricks. It is the clay of the bricks itself. We actually know this from the name charoset. Most believe that the word charoset derives from the Hebrew word cheres, which, as Susan mentioned, is a potsherd or pottery. But in general, I think that there's something very interesting of what took place here with the charoset. And this applies to many of the foods that Jews eat on various holidays. It is the idea of assigning symbolism to something that perhaps wasn't originally symbolic. In this case, as Susan argued, the source may have been something medical, or at least for taste. And the Jews looked at this and decided to apply symbolism to it. And I think that this says a lot about the Jewish people as an ancient people. Ancient people believe that there's meanings in things always. Things don't just happen coincidentally. This is long before the age of reason. So if we can't identify the reason we eat a food, we might invoke symbolism as the meaning for it. We see it, as I said, in other holiday foods as well. For example, on the holiday of Shavuot that's coming up in a few months, which commemorates the giving of the Torah at Sinai, many Jewish communities around the world will eat dairy foods. I've come across so many reasons, perhaps 40 or 50 different reasons why this is the custom. And I believe that if everybody gives you the same reason for something, then perhaps there's some truth in it. But if everybody gives you a different reason, then probably none of them are correct. Most likely, the reason that we eat dairy on Shavuot is simply because milk was abundant at the end of spring, beginning of summer, when Shavuot falls, or at least in the Northern Hemisphere. That became something that was around, and so we started to eat dairy foods and then found reasonings for it. Similarly, on the holiday of Rosh Hashanah, there are a number of symbolic foods that people traditionally eat, and they will recite a certain formula of blessing based on each of these foods. And again, it seems that the reason that these are the foods that are eaten is because they were seasonally available then. Ancient people will look at those seasonal foods and they'll ask, okay, but why are these the foods that are in season now? There must be a reason. Same thing with Hanukkah. There are many foods that people eat that are fried in oil. And this is often connected with the miracle of the oil that is said to have taken place in the temple at the time of the holiday of Hanukkah. But this does not seem to be actually historically the original purpose of the holiday of Hanukkah. The earliest sources make no mention of any miracle. And in fact, it seems that it was a holiday both to celebrate the rededication of the temple after it was desecrated by the Greeks, as well as a celebration of Jewish self-rule. On Purim, we essentially eat our enemy. There are many foods, not only hamantaschen, that are very popular today, but many Jewish communities around the world eat other body parts of Haman, the villain of the Purim story. Haman's eyes, Haman's feet, Haman's teeth, etc. We see a continued pattern of Jews finding or assigning symbolism in foods that they eat for different reasons. With the oily foods of Hanukkah and the Haman's body parts of Purim, I don't believe that those are because these foods were seasonally available, just that we found foods that we might have liked to have eaten and said, we're not just eating any food, rather we are eating foods that are relevant to the holiday, that are significant, that symbolize something. Now, when I say these things about our holiday foods, some people find it disappointing. We're very invested in the stories we tell. I don't believe this should be disappointing. I believe that there's a benefit in the stories that we tell. These are expressions of our values and our beliefs. It should be beautiful when we look at what are the meanings that we apply or assign to these foods. It shouldn't matter whether charoset originally was a symbol of the clay from the bricks or was a medicinal corrective. We look at this food that we're eating on a holiday at a very special meal, and we elevate it to something meaningful. It gives us a deeper connection to the holiday. And now we almost have the opposite, where rather than looking at a food and finding meaning for it, we're taking the food that already has meaning and changing some of the ingredients to give it further significance. For example, Shes Rishon, otherwise known as Manish Tana, his pen name, is an African-American Orthodox rabbi. And he suggests that African-American Jews use for their haroset certain slave crop ingredients, pecans, cocoa powder, figs, and sugarcane. I find absolutely nothing wrong with this. In fact, I think it's a brilliant thing to do. It is what Jews have always done, to find meaning. And if one can express their hybrid personality in the foods that we eat on a holiday that is so important, I say go for it. On a holiday that celebrates freedom, we must embrace that freedom to explore and express in different ways. On the next episode, we will have one more food that is connected with the season. It is muffletta, and my guests, yes, guests plural, will be the Sephardic Spice Girls.
Thanks for listening, and I hope you enjoyed. Got any questions or comments? Please feel free to email me at jewishfoodbook@gmail.com. Please listen, like, and follow wherever you get your podcasts, and I would truly appreciate it if you'd share this with other Jewish food lovers. The theme music you hear is Adir Hu Revisited by Rebbe Sol. Check him out wherever you stream music. And as always, until next time, I wish you B'tei Avon.